We'll open up Senate Committee on Business and Transportation and Workforce Development for another winter-like day on Wednesday. Just a reminder, committee members, we will be recessing after today's regular session. We'll be back at 5 o'clock. We do not have a meeting tomorrow. So, with that, let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 443 and ask the wise and powerful Revenue Chairman, Senator Ryan Deckert, to please come forward.
Does Janet want to do a brief introduction of the Dash 6s because Jimmy is grabbing the testimony? So I can give...
I tell you what, I think I'll have you do it because we all recently got the Dash 6s, and I think that we better just have you walk through it in this case.
I tried, Janet, to give you... Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, Workforce Development, as Tommy Brooks, who's been working on this issue a great deal, makes his way down next to me, and I am Ryan Deckert, State Senator from Washington County. Great. What you see before you, and first probably I should talk about what this bill is not, because folks who were here a couple years ago, and I certainly am one that would, with no hesitation, argue that customer-owned power or utility is an option that folks ought to have. I'd also preface that by saying that being a customer of investor-owned PG in this case, utility, I'm a happy customer. And what has happened over the last couple of years in terms of the developments with PG returning to its core, as I said yesterday with the Beaverton Chamber of Commerce, this has been a incredibly positive development for Oregonians and for residences and businesses large and small. The reason that you see Senate Bill 443 before you is I think it is imperative that any state craft solutions and really prepare for what would be a worst-case scenario. And what we saw a few years ago was, I think, at least had all the hallmarks of a worst-case scenario where an out-of-state interest had obtained control over our utility, PGE, and we had, and what we witnessed as Oregonians is a very disorganized process, one that few, even the folks that were the closest to it, whether that was in terms of meeting with, I think, at that point, all parties, few felt good and thought we had the most thoughtful process in place for an outside entity or for customers to begin a conversation. And so, Mr. Chair, that is why you see Senate Bill 443 before you, because I think you need and feel pretty strongly that for preparing your citizens, you have to have a framework in place, because if you don't, we do know what occurs. And I would argue with the repeal of PUCA, and Tommy Brooks will give you other information, but with the repeal of PUCA at the federal level, utility ownership is now broadened, and I think there's several examples across the country in the last 2 years of where this broadening has been exercised. But I believe it would be just a very big mistake for Oregon to take a pass and think we live through a tough 2 or 3 years with a very good outcome, and if this were to occur in 10 years, 15, 20 years, I think all the same folks that were involved in that debate 2 or 3 years ago, who all almost uniformly said, wouldn't it have been nice if there was a state statute that at least gave an organized process. And so what we have done with Senate Bill 443 is we've tried to meet with, again, all the parties interested, certainly the utilities, PGE and PacifiCorp, the customer groups, large and small, from ICNU to CUB, to answer the question of how do you craft a statute that at least, at the very least, and put it on the books, that organizes this process so you don't have what we saw a couple years ago. And so that is the recommendation in 4043, and I'll turn it over to Tommy to walk you through the sections of the Dash 6s, Mr. Chair.
Well, why don't we start with that? Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, as Senator Decker said, my name is Tommy Brooks. I'm on his staff, and I've been working to try to craft this bill, and specifically to make the changes necessary from the version that passed last session to something this session. I'll be glad to answer as many questions as I can about the specific sections, but I really want to hit the major changes, and that begins with Section 2, which is on page 2. Senator Decker said this bill provides a framework for capturing an ongoing effort when there is a move to purchase a utility and put it into public ownership. And what Section 2 does is determine whether or not there really is that ongoing effort and if there is something to capture. Basically, what we did was we provided through this language a two-step triggering mechanism, and if this trigger is if this part of the statute is met, then Oregon Community Power will be established, and if it's not, then the remainder of the provisions will remain dormant until they are met. It begins with a transaction for control or purchase of a utility involving 50% of that utility. And current state law requires a filing with the PUC when someone intends to exercise control over an investor-owned utility, and this keys off of that filing with the PUC. And when that happens, the PUC would then notify all the cities and counties within the service territory of that utility. So that's the first step. The second step would be that each city and county would have the choice to appoint someone to an acquisition review committee. And the purpose of that committee would be to look at the situation and determine if indeed public power is the best option for the ratepayers at that time. The only way for that committee to move forward is if by affirmative vote of members of that committee representing two-thirds of the customers in the utility's service area, only then could the bill move forward. If that happens, then the rest of the bill goes into effect and Oregon Community Power is established.
Tommy, can I say one thing?
Sure.
So we chose that high marker. I mean, you have two high thresholds there, but we chose what I think is a pretty high marker, two-thirds, to really, I think just to meet that marker of two-thirds of the customer base really means something is afoot, something that is concerning a great deal of residents and business customers at that point is occurring. And that's why, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we chose, I think, a pretty tough standard two-step to even get to the third step that Mr. Brooks will talk about.
So most of the remainder of the provisions deal with providing Oregon Community Power with the authority to operate as a utility and to also make the acquisition of the utility, and I'll highlight a few of those. Mainly, I'd like to first go to Section 11, and that's on page 11. And also, I'm working from the dash 6 amendments, just in case there's any. Section 11 speaks to whether or not the utility being acquired is going to have the power of eminent domain. There's another section that we'll get to, I believe that's in third, or I'm not sure, under Section 17 maybe, but in general, eminent domain is a power that utilities need to operate to do their operations within their service territory. So this bill does provide the Oregon Community Power with that authority. However, it then goes on to limit how Oregon Community Power can use that power of eminent domain. And in Section 11, what it basically says is that the Oregon Community Power cannot actually make the acquisition of the utility through eminent domain. So the point is it's going to be a purchase and not a takeover. There's, if you go on to Section 17, which I believe is on page 14, what this section does is it speaks a little bit to the money that Oregon Community Power can receive from the state. In general, the goal here is not to establish Oregon Community Power as a state agency, but as a ratepayer-owned utility. But there will be, obviously, instances where money goes from the state. So the proceeds from any bonds that are going to be passed through the state are the utility is allowed to receive. And then any monies that the utility is owed by virtue of the state being a customer of Oregon Community Power. So the bill just lets that occur. All of the funds from the state are segregated, so the funds of Oregon Community Power are not part of the state's general fund, and any obligations of Oregon Community Power are not obligations of the state of Oregon.
Say that again.
The bill segregates the monies of the utility from the monies of the state. So Oregon Community Power's revenues and funds are not considered part of the general fund of the state.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Mona Sanderson, on that point, it was critical, obviously, and had to define out this entity, Oregon Community Power. We should always be mindful of the barriers to that we've put in the bill, with, I think, pretty high thresholds that one would have to meet in terms of the whole community of a utility having to come together, or two-thirds of that customer base, also the first barrier. But what you see in Section 18 and 19 and 20 is really what we had to do, which is work with the varied interests in the utility, from the customers to the utility themselves, and at least define this entity so that if we do find ourselves in the situation, we have a defined entity and one that is prescribed in statute what it can and cannot do, and that's the section that Mr. Brooks is walking you through.
Senator Starr had a question before we continue.
Thank you, and it's in Section 17, lines 21 through 24. Seems like a pretty broad exemption to pursue a court, take the utility to court by any retail electricity consumer. Can you tell me why that's in the statute here, and is that consistent with what other publicly consumer-owned utilities have in statute today, or is that unique to this particular idea?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, this really was what was negotiated 2 years ago in terms of definition of the entity, and that's where we arrived at this. But we think it was one that is pretty representative of other customer-owned utilities on questions such as that.
Okay, thank you.
The next section that I'd like to discuss is Section 21, and that's on page 20. And that's where the general authority of Oregon Community Power to have eminent domain comes from. And as I said earlier, this is the establishment of that authority for the utility so that it can undergo its normal utility operations. And it's limited in that first section that I mentioned to you, but it's also limited again in this section and basically says that Oregon Community Power also cannot use eminent domain to expand outside of its territory and take over other service territories. So again, it's just another limit on that power. Section 27 is on.
Before you go on
Senator
page. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 21 on page 20, when you're talking about eminent domain, that's pretty controversial, isn't it? For Oregon, they may exercise the power of eminent domain. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think that for the purpose that it's being limited to, it's not that controversial. Utilities
okay.
need eminent domain to operate if they need to run new distribution lines within their service territory,
okay.
new transmission lines. It's a tool that I think any utility will tell you they have to have
okay.
within their service
Thank
territory.
You. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, PGE, although this does not just relate to PGE, and it's important to note if there's any folks writing about this, that it is not, because sometimes folks get confused, and this is not about any immediate questions with Portland General Electric, but they raised that question, and I think we've come to a solution in terms of eminent domain to really limit this entity into what any utility would need in terms of eminent domain, but not giving it extra powers that perhaps a local government might have to wield over any private entity, utility, restaurant, any private entity.
Section 27 is on page 24, and this section addresses access that Oregon Community Power will have to a federal power resource. And the bill that passed last session the way that it read was that Oregon Community Power would not have priority at Bonneville, but it also says that Oregon Community Power is not an investor-owned utility. And under the federal statutes, what that basically does is remove any access to the federal resource by Oregon Community Power. So we reworked this section to make sure that Oregon Community Power still have access to that benefit, but making the policy clear, as it was last session, that Oregon Community Power won't have preference and that it won't compete with the community-owned utilities by virtue of how they interact with the federal resources. So that does that. Additionally, the Acquisition Review Committee that I mentioned earlier, part of in Section 2, explicitly has to decide that these policies can be met before they can move forward. So this isn't just policy that's sitting there that may or may not be met. It's part of that decision-making process, and it's part of that original trigger. And so we just try to spell that out really, really clearly. I hate to jump around a little bit, but I'd like to go back to Section 5, which is on page 5, and subsection 3 of that begins on line 26. Right now, the way that this amendment reads, and this is left over from last session, says that Oregon Community Power may not be required to obtain the approval of the PUC to make an acquisition described in the bill. And I think from talking to Senator Decker, we'd actually like to figure out if we can remove that piece and have the PUC involved in this. PUC has a good track record of showing what's best for utilities, making sure that acquisitions are in the benefit of the ratepayers. And basically, by removing that, it would maintain the status quo. If a city right now were to try to carve off a piece of a utility, it would have to go before the PUC to do that. And so the intention would be to maintain that level of check on the transaction. Other than that, a lot of the bill is just the authority for Oregon Community Power to issue revenue bonds so they can enter into financing agreements and operate as a normal board would. And I think that's it for me.
So, Mr. Chair, I would only say in closing, two things. One is important is that we have hoped in this endeavor and talked to members of this committee and you, Mr. Chair, and certainly outside interest, is to quietly move a bill through that really has that protections. And so I think it's important, though, because I was distressed at least the Portland Business Journal put a headline, State to Purchase PGE. And that is not the intent. And if folks anywhere hear that is not the intent of this bill. It is obviously, and all one has to do is look at the amendments to see what the intent it is to think through, and that is the question I would pose to this committee, is why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we put something on the books that provides some thoughtful, organized way with really tough thresholds in place, and I don't know that you could get any tougher, frankly, thresholds to getting to that moment. But why, as we, as residents, as businesses, not have some protections available to us if we happen to find ourselves, and I think there's ample evidence that it could, it probably, hopefully, won't, but we do risk assessment in this building, and why wouldn't we do some level of risk assessment to assure the economy of our state, who has always had a competitive advantage in terms of energy costs, and that obviously is not as great today as it used to be. But the thought to me that we wouldn't, and then whenever, if ever, we did find ourselves in a pretty tough environment for our families and for our businesses, and to look back and think the state had an opportunity to put something, it's tough, it's rigorous, but something on the books, because I guarantee what we would see is something akin to what we saw a few years ago, where you would have some folks in some communities do PUD elections. You'd have some folks in some communities using every tool at their disposal, but not having any state statutory framework at all to rely upon. You'd have some folks in local government and other trying to needle together intergovernmental agreements, which is where you came up with the name Oregon Community Power, because that was the name that was given to some of the counties that were trying to come up with these intergovernmental agreements. And to me, that is us fumbling our responsibility, is to provide some thought to this and use state statute where it's appropriate. And that is what we hope to have done here. And I thank Mr. Brooks and the utilities, at least, for giving good counsel, and customer groups for spending at least 2 years ago a great deal of time trying to think through this entity, and all the other groups that care about our energy future. Because to me, and I know I feel probably more passionately than, too many people, or I feel too passionately about this, but to me it would be just such a huge missed opportunity for us not to quietly put something there that, in the worst case scenario, we could call upon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Questions for Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, you and I talked a little bit on the floor, and I kind of want to go back over. Here's what I'm a little nervous about. This is an entity comes in to purchase a power company in the state of Oregon, and they start going through the process. There's this separate process created by this piece of legislation that, in essence, and I obviously haven't read the amendments because we just got them, but creates a separate process and perhaps a first right of refusal. So the deals don't have to be. I mean, it almost would. It would put people who are coming in to look at buying a utility. They would question whether or not they wanted to look at one of our utilities because of the fact that there's this mechanism sitting in state law where they could go through a ton of work and then be preempted. And I don't want to make this a first right of refusal, I guess, is what I'm looking at. I'm just a little nervous about that dual process and then it being a disincentive to people looking at one of our utilities that may be in the best advantage for our ratepayers. I don't know if you could address that a little bit for me.
Maybe I'll take a quick swing at it and then tell me if you want to. Just having witnessed this, and we all in Oregon actually have witnessed this a few times in the last decade, I mean, the first answer, Mr. Chair and Senator George, that I would give is that those interested parties usually do a pretty effective job at the first thing, which is going out into the community and talking to folks. And so the second threshold that we put in the bill, I think, would render that decision pretty, you could come to that decision pretty quickly, because by talking to three or four representatives of local government and helping them understand your interest in their utility. And to me, that's actually very helpful, the PUC process, but also the process that any interested party begins with, which is going out into the community and talking about their plans for their utility. I think they would have a really hard time they could look at that second threshold and get a couple of nods pretty quickly that, no, we're pretty much in agreement to what you're trying to do. And knowing the climate in Oregon, I think that would occur. But Tommy, you might want to.
Chairman Metzger, Senator George, there's nothing in the bill right now that would give any priority to this process. So that's the first right of refusal. I mean, they would be going along at the same time, and especially if we can get where the PUC has a say, then it would be on different criteria other than just that one is public power and one is not. Also, Section 2, page 3, there's a subsection 6 that requires that the negotiations be conducted expeditiously and not interfere with other negotiations or offers. So hopefully that provides sort of the urgency once the process gets going, so that it's not a disincentive to others and maybe other offers who are actually out of the gates first by nature of how the trigger works. This can't really hold that up.
Mr. Chair, I guess whoever else will testify on this, if we could get kind of a discussion on this, you see the environment that I don't want to create. I don't want to create an environment where we have somebody comes in with a good faith offer for one of our utilities, and then all of a sudden the public goes, or somebody in the public eye who's a leader in the community says, oh, we want to create this other process, and then there's this battling situation, and then what it does becomes a disincentive to investments from investment firms or utilities from outside our area who may be willing to put some investment here in our region. I just don't want to become a disincentive to investment in our region because we have this process sitting on the books that would make it riskier for me to make an offer on a utility. And that's where I'm trying to get at. I don't want to create that environment.
The only other thought I have, Mr. Chair and Senator George, is look at what we got today. I mean, in terms of risk, I'd much rather have something like this where I know the structure and the hoops that folks have to jump through, because the environment I have today is I don't know which person is going to get elected where of the many jurisdictions, state, city, county, PUD, you name it, that might start in. I can count three or four just on the top of my head in the last 5 or 6 years where you had people banging the drum on a different plan, I had one, so I'm maybe five. I'm maybe one of those. And to me, if I'm an outside interested party, show me one that I can count on, read, see the commas and see the periods, and then I know the certainty that I need that I'm getting into. The current climate you have is you could have a different set of folks get elected somewhere, and off we go. And to the offer table. And to me, I would just prefer, if I was that outside party, I'd prefer something like this where at least I know the shape of the field, then it is game on, and I just don't know where the game is.
One last question.
Mm-hmm.
The only other issue that, Senator, that I brought up with you was the PUC process, and I noticed that you guys are willing to do it. So are you going to bring forward some other amendments to come forward and take that and require this process to go through the PUC process? Are we going to see some separate amendments on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I spoke to Senator George. I think he's right. And then we talked over the noon hour, and we think you're right, and I'd be prepared to do that either in this committee or in the House. But it is my pledge, and I believe this entity should go through that same process that the PUC. It creates another barrier, and we talked about maybe some conflicts. But to me, you need a very rigorous, and it's tough to get more rigorous, but I'm pledged to do that, to have this entity go through the PUC process as the final step.
Thank you.
Senator, I had a question. On the eminent domain issue, which we have in Section 11 and then again on Section 21, but on page 11 in Section 11, page 11, I guess, based on your testimony, you indicated that you do not intend to have eminent domain as a way to acquire the utility through normal eminent domain condemnation processes, that you want only to use it as an affirmative action with the agreement of the utility in order to accomplish the sale. Is that a correct interpretation of your testimony?
That is, and Mr. Brooks has been doing a lot of research on that very question, and so I will say that is, but I'll let him.
But not an adverse use of the.
That's correct.
Okay, I guess because the only thing council might have to review this, but my concern on that is on page 11, and it's the first word on line 23, and it says they cannot use it, or they may use it, if the incumbent utility, it goes on. So it doesn't specifically prohibit it in my reading of it. To me, it would have to say something like they may use it only if, not just if. I don't think it's as restrictive. I mean, it seems permissive, but it doesn't seem to be restrictive. In other words, that you couldn't use eminent domain otherwise. I think it would be more powerful if that's the intent, is to say, you know, you may use this only if, you know, the people who have authority, not just if. It just doesn't seem to be quite as clear to me. But let's take a look at that and have some interpretations.
We got there, Mr. Chair, with counsel, but happy to.
Yeah.
Because we thought folks were generally in agreement on the eminent.
Yeah. I mean, I think that'd be, because going to back to what Senator George asked, if you're competing for an asset in the business world and you're competing, say, with the public for this purchase, well, I would say that would be a fair business transaction if you're both making your bids and competing on the same field. But if the eminent domain, but if you're looking to purchase a utility in which the public could just say, heck with it, I am going to use eminent domain, and then there really is not a fair competition because you know this hammer could come down. I just wanted to make sure that would be clear. I may be wrong. We'll hear from the utilities, but
I would say most purchasers probably would have no objections to competing on a level playing field with an offer. But if someone had had a hammer that was greater than theirs that they could use, saying, okay, I'm done negotiating, I'm going to exercise eminent domain and just take it, that would have a chilling effect, I think, on making an offer. So I just think making that clear would be important. Any other questions for this group? Okay, thank you very much. Let's hear from Ron Ekus. And let me ask Ron Ekus and Ryan Flynn to come forward. They're not together, but they both sign up in opposition, and we'll try to move through here. And we'll start with Mr. Ekus. Welcome, Mr. Ekus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Ekus. I'm testifying on this bill today as both a former legislator in the 1985 and 1987 sessions and as a former member and chairman of the Public Utility Commission from 1987 to 2001. Since then, I've been an independent consultant, primarily focusing on international activities supporting creation of electricity regulatory bodies in developing countries. In the interest of disclosure, though, I should also note that I've recently been retained by PGE, primarily for the purpose of developing a project for expanding the company's dialogue with its customers. This testimony, however, is my own. It's not being delivered on behalf of the company or anyone else but myself. PGE is aware of my perspective on it, but my remarks have not been shared with them, nor reviewed or approved by them. Consequently, I'm expressing my own views in my own terms and freely offering my own alternatives. My interest in this bill is based on my 14 years' experience as a member of the commission, during which time I participated in several reviews of proposed utility mergers and acquisitions. My primary concerns with the bill center on three issues and the contradictions I feel are associated with those. First, it unnecessarily creates a redundant process that confuses, complicates, and undermines the underlying principles of the Public Utility Commission process. From a consumer point of view, it could increase costs and deprive customers of benefits. It can do that by devaluing the utility and discouraging any acquisition that might otherwise provide net benefits because it triggers the mechanism for forming Oregon Community Power upon a PUC filing on a deal already struck. And third, by tying the implementation to a filing of an already concluded agreement before the PUC, the bill actually restricts the ability of local governments to negotiate with a utility. Essentially, in its present form, the bill allows local governments to hijack the PUC proceeding and any private investors' agreements by conducting their own review of a proposed transaction and entering into their own negotiations to substitute themselves as the new owners. And I think in my written testimony, I said under the threat of eminent domain, it should be scratched because I think we've reached a greater understanding of how that's being used. So as soon as a private entity has conducted its due diligence, concluded a negotiation transaction agreement with the incumbent utility, and made the required filing to the PUC, it will be subject not only to a PUC review, but to review by the local government's acquisition review committee. So at the same time there's a PUC review to determine net benefits, the ARC will be conducting its own review outside of established procedures and legal criteria of the PUC. The PUC process has worked, as evidenced by past decisions which have either assured net benefits to customers or denied approval for those that did not. And a Texas Pacific example is the most recent. PUC has the expertise to review the transactions, and its process is based on procedural rules, laws, and legal precedent that provide for an independent and objective analysis insulated from political interference. The ARC review provides no such procedural guarantees, nor does it provide any criteria upon which the determination of best interests are to be made. It creates a much more subjective forum. And by moving it into the decision realm of elected officials rather than a regulatory review, it creates a much more politicized process. And since review is being conducted by a potential buyer, the principle of independence is forsaken. It also creates a very confusing and uncertain process. What is the expectation of what the PUC is supposed to be doing while the ARC is conducting its review? Will the ARC or its members be participating in the PUC review at the same time they're conducting their own review? As constructed, I think it's possible the bill may actually work against the interests of consumers. The prospect that any future merger or acquisition could be subject to being derailed by a takeover by OCP will devalue the incumbent utilities. No one knows how the utilities in Oregon will develop in the future, and no one knows how the industry will evolve. We do know there have been transactions in the past that have provided net benefits to customers, and we should assume that such an event might be possible in the future. The financial market is likely to take into account the fact that any acquisition agreements have to go through a duplicate, highly politicized process in which local governments in the state can try and supersede an already tendered and accepted offer. The resulting reduction in the value of the utility could lead to corresponding increases in costs for the utility and hence its consumers. But I think more important is that having to go through such a process will actually discourage any entity who could conclude a transaction providing net benefits from actually considering doing so in Oregon. This is the bill's major contradiction. It discourages the very trigger mechanism that it relies upon to set OCP in motion in the first place. And as such, it is likely to prevent any future transactions that could provide net benefits. Why should anyone consider a merger or acquisition of an Oregon IOU if it has to go through the process envisioned in this bill, in which after it reaches an agreement, OCP can step in and begin negotiating with the utility? Another contradiction is the condition that negotiations by ARC may not interfere with other negotiations or offers. Reality is, how would you really expect ARC to conduct negotiations and not interfere with an agreement that has already been made and is before the PUC for review? Interference is impossible to avoid if the utility has already made an agreement with one entity and then must enter into negotiations for an agreement with another entity for the same sale. The condition for activation of OCP is also confusing. As I read Section 2 and Section 7, OCP can only be activated if an agreement is reached between the ARC and the utility. But why would the utility decide to breach its disagreement with another buyer, for which it has already filed with the PUC, when it's likely to have to pay a fee for backing out of a deal it already made? And if OCP can only be activated if there's agreement, why wouldn't the utility simply say no thanks and end the negotiation? If that's all it takes, then at the review and negotiation stage, eminent domain is irrelevant because it's not forcing any takeover. Sale takes a willing seller as well as a willing buyer. The bill does provide with the power of eminent domain. However, it doesn't appear that that can be used to force a transaction should the utility be unwilling to sell, because OCP doesn't come into existence until there is agreement, and as we've heard, the clarification isn't for actual takeover. So let's just use a little thought experiment here. You have a utility that has negotiated an agreement with another buyer. It comes before the PUC as required by law. The PUC is supposed to review that, whether there are net benefits. The PUC provides an independent process. All parties have an opportunity to participate, carry out discovery. They can go through that process, and you can have a transaction that either provides net benefits and gets approved, or it doesn't provide net benefits and it's denied. What you're setting up here is that once that filing is done, local governments then have the opportunity to decide that now they want to negotiate. But it's not a bidding process because, you know, the utility's already made an agreement. And so now you have the local governments coming in, being able to negotiate. You're now forming an entity that can negotiate. But you don't form community power until an agreement's reached. But the likelihood, and you've got two unlikely events here. One is, I'm not sure that anyone would actually make a transaction with the utility if it knows if it comes into Oregon, it's got to have this other process. And that a public entity can step in at that point in time and try and negotiate to beat an offer that's already been accepted. And second, I don't understand why the utility, having already made the deal, would simply say, I'm sorry, I'm not interested. We're done. So that the problem here to me is that I think maybe creating a situation where consumers don't get benefits either way. They don't get the potential of net benefits because we're making it harder for someone to come in and do an acquisition that would provide net benefits. And at the same time, we're restricting the ability of when Oregon Community Power or the local governments can actually negotiate. I'm not opposed to the concept of Oregon Community Power. The problem isn't with that concept. The problem is with the trigger mechanism. It's hard to understand the purpose of tying initiation of OCP to an already agreed upon sale, which will undergo full review by the PUC. The concerns that arose last session during Texas Pacific buyout of PGE and the continuing efforts of Portland to buy PGE have passed. At this point, in this stage, structured this way, the bill seems to me a lot like a rebel without a cause. The goal of creating a mechanism on which the whole of an IOU territory can be publicly acquired, instead of breaking it up piecemeal through multiple PUD efforts, is laudable. But why should it be limited to initiation only after the utility has already agreed to sell to another entity? Under this bill, that's the only time local governments can negotiate to buy out an IOU using the Oregon Community Power model. The IOU may have a fiduciary responsibility to consider all offers, but at this point, the ARC is well behind the curve. It's in a position of trying to force the utility to renegotiate something it's already agreed upon, and it's in a position of affecting and confusing an already existing process before the PUC. So I looked at this and I asked, well, wouldn't it make more sense to create a mechanism for deciding to conduct due diligence in negotiation with the utility that can be implemented by local governments at any time that the local governments feel it's necessary? What this alternative does is it changes the threshold. Under this bill, the threshold becomes whether or not a utility has decided it wants to sell to somebody else. Under an approach that does not use that sale as a trigger, the threshold becomes one of quality of service and how well a utility is operating consistent with the interests of Oregon and the values and needs of its customers. If an IOU is failing in this regard, then local governments might be able to garner enough support to initiate a negotiation. But under the current bill, they have to wait until someone else decides to buy the utility and then insert themselves after the fact in a manner that complicates, confuses, and delays the PUC process that we already have in place. I don't think that that's necessarily in the best interest of customers. I realize you're operating under time constraints, but this is significant legislation that I think can have serious negative effects. I would urge the committee to take the time to rework the bill so it's no longer based upon someone else deciding to acquire the IOU and to attend to all other provisions in the bill that may need clarification or elaboration. But essentially, I think it's the trigger mechanism that's the problem, because you now have a mechanism whereby a utility makes a deal, agrees to a deal with somebody else. That deal may provide net benefits, but once it does that, it's subject to a process in which local governments can now decide, well, I want to buy it. And it's really, I'm not sure that the practical matter is that because it adds on to the process for approval that could discourage a sale that might provide net benefits, and at the same time, if there is a sale, I'm not sure it has any practical application anyway, because all the utility has to do is say, I'm not interested in negotiating with you. In the meantime, the PUC process has to wait and figure out what's going on with the review, what's going on with the negotiations, and all of those other parties, local governments and others, have the opportunity to participate in the review. I think it's better to have a process, as the senator is trying to create, where local governments can, in fact, establish an entity to make an offer to a utility, but don't restrict it. Don't make it triggered only when there is a sale. That's the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Mr. Ricas? No. Mr. Flynn?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Flynn. I'm with the Office of General Counsel for PacifiCorp. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on SB 443, the Oregon Community Power Act. What I'd like to do is give a quick overview of PacifiCorp and then address some concerns we have with the bill. As you're aware, PacifiCorp...
Mr. Flynn, if you can just do it as concisely and as quickly as you can, because we're losing committee time.
Absolutely. PacifiCorp is an investor-owned utility. We have operations in six states. We serve 1.7 million customers. In Oregon, we have 550,000 retail customers. We are typically the lowest-cost electric provider in the state and, indeed, in the region. As to the legislation... We appreciate your work to encourage stable and responsible utility ownership. We agree with that principle. Our concerns are as follows, and in some cases they're unique to PacifiCorp, although we do agree with many of the gentlemen's concerns as well. First, we'd like to see the PUC have control of the acquisition process. We feel that they have a robust and transparent regulatory process in place. They can distinguish between good and bad actors in the industry. And we also believe that the PUC is in the position to avoid unnecessary delays and avoid any modifications to the investment climate in Oregon. For PacifiCorp, we also have, we're investor-owned, but we only have four investors. And so for us, there's a concern about whether the seamless succession of interest in the corporation would actually trigger the OCP provisions in the legislation. For instance, through life circumstances, if one of our investors were to pass on or otherwise, and we had a successor in interest, would that then trigger this act? Our third concern is that we are a six-state utility, and as such, if the OCP were to acquire service territory within Oregon, would that also mean that they would then need to acquire generation assets for interests that are outside the state to serve load in the state? Also, is the OCP prepared to negotiate and abide by other state jurisdictional rules and regulations that may impact that service territory? And finally, there may be ratepayer increases in other state jurisdictions that we currently operate in if the service territory within Oregon was to come under the control of the OCP. So ultimately, we have more questions than answers right now, but we do agree with the principles of the bill for stable and responsible utility ownership, and we are happy to take questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Flynn? Thank you. Would it be possible for you to provide testimony to the committee?
We could arrange that, absolutely.
That would be terrific. Thank you. Last up to testify, we have Dave Robertson, Jay Dudley, and Tom Gallagher. And brevity is appreciated.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Robertson. I'm Director of Government Affairs here with Jay for Portland General Electric. Here with Jay Dudley of our legal shop and Tom Gallagher, who also works in our Government Affairs group. I think we'd like to express today that we fundamentally disagree with the need for Senate Bill 443. The whole structure of the bill was created back in a time which was a once-in-a-lifetime situation that no longer exists. PGE is now an independent company. We're an Oregon-based company, and we're proud to be so, and glad we're actually back. We've tried to work with Senator Deckert and crafting a structure for this bill that may work, but we still have some pretty strong concerns with the way the bill is set up right now. First of all, the bill, there are some sections of statute, Chapter 190 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, for instance, that allow intergovernmental agreements. And the structure that's put in place now was really built around that unique situation where Enron still owned PGE, and there were various pieces of that you see in this bill regarding Bonneville Power, regarding other things that were in place at that time regarding direct access. That was a bill passed by the legislature in 1999. And I think a lot has, not that direct access has changed, I'm just saying that this framework could get locked into statute and may over time not be as flexible as the legislature might want it to be. The bill, I think our most fundamental concern is the bill, and I'm glad to hear that Senator Deckert and his staff have been thinking about the OPUC's role, but our biggest concern is that the bill, as it's written now, eliminates one of the customer's biggest protections, which is the authority of the PUC to evaluate a purchase offer to protect the interests of our customers, including the guarantee that net benefits will be provided to our customers. I think the agency has proven in the past that, and in past transactions, that it has the tools, the expertise, the resources to make sure that it can either deny an offer if it makes no sense for customers, or to really lean on that purchaser to come in and provide benefits to consumers. The bill also is got a number of questions, and back to my initial point about it being addressing a 2005 situation, there are a number of pieces in here that are somewhat contradictory and at times, depending on the situation, could make little sense. You've got a consumer-owned utility that can't access BPA power. You would have a consumer-owned utility that's partially regulated by the PUC. You would have a public entity that's required to pay all franchise fees, privilege taxes, and property taxes like a business to make sure local governments remain whole. I think the parallel processes that are set up in Section 2, and I only looked at the Dash 5s when I was working on these statements, so the sections may have changed. But those parallel processes can interfere with each other. I do think that the comments of former PUC Chair Ekus are true, and that I think it's very hard to say in a discretionary way that this may not interfere with what's going on at the PUC when it very well could interfere with that. One of our other main concerns, and I'll just wrap it up and open for questions, is that there are really no time limits on how this could work. Expeditiously is, I think, a nice addition, but I think without some hard time frames, once this thing gets kicked off, is it in place? How long does it hang around out there? How long do we work with this particular entity to try to decide whether we should or shouldn't be on the blocks? And so I think we've got a lot of questions. We do acknowledge and appreciate that the senator's work to try to address some of those concerns, and I'm now open for questions.
I think we'll go to the next testimony first.
Okay, thank you.
Whoever's next.
I don't think we have any specific testimony. We're here for...
You're all support crew. I see.
Yeah, these are...
decoration.
Okay.
Homies.
Okay, well, it's a very fine-looking panel now. any questions for Mr. Robertson or the bookends? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have no one else signed up to testify in 443. Anybody would like to testify at the moment on Senate Bill 443? Nobody? Okay. No. All right. What I'm going to do is close the public hearing on Senate Bill 443. What I'm going to ask Senator Deckert, I mean, this is a very big bill. We just got the amendment today, and there's apparently a few things we need to do. I will reschedule the bill on Monday to give time to get that done. Also, to request that a fiscal statement so we can see whether or not we have a ways or means issue, and then we can have a chance to deal with that in advance. And then we will schedule this for a possible work session on Monday. I want everybody who's had an opportunity to really read through these. I know it's fresh, and that's why I want you to have a few more days to do that. And then also Senator Deckert for some of the amendments that you talked about here, to have those prepared. And then we will set that for Monday and hopefully have a fiscal statement and have a more complete picture. So thank you very much. What I'm going to do now, yes, Senator Deckert.
Just one, for folks that have constructive, and I heard that, and this is obviously not a new concept. It's been around for a couple of years, and then in the latest iteration. So if they can get any constructive suggestions to our office this week, we should have them ready by Monday of next week.
Okay, thank you. Yes. Okay. I'm kind of stalling here a little bit because I know I got Janet in motion here, but we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 350. And while we're getting our list, Mr. Salzgiver, Mr. Repine, if you want to come forward, these are the, quote, warm amendments that we got. Senator Deckard's had cooled just a little bit, but these are actually were hot when we got them. I mean,
we're not moving these either, right?
Yeah, these are, this is like 100 and, I count 109 Dalmatians or whatever, so 108 pages. And if you remember, this is our big omnibus bill on economic development. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the records, I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Economic Community Development. I know that I think Senator Johnson and Representative Edwards were coming in to testify, too, so I suspect
we're calling them now.
Calling them also. Let me just make my brief comments that I'll make, then either yield to them or move on to Mr. Salzgiver. You do have the Dash 1 amendments that are in front of you, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair. In the time of the hearing, the testimony that just took place in front of us, we were able to go through the bill to see if it has all the components that we thought will be in the bill. And we believe that all the components that we requested of the Dash 1 amendments are in the bill, since we received it the same time you did. So I think we have some consistency there. I want to make sure that everybody understands this is an omnibus bill. To the extent that I don't want anybody to, maybe we have overstated, and if we have, I want to apologize. This is a bill that is not earth-changing issues for the agency. This is a bill, you know, it has cleanup components in it, it has housekeeping components in it, but I fundamentally believe that we need to get these changes completed in order to start this agency on a direction of making it an agency that works in economic developments in the behalf of the future of Oregon. And what we've tried to do is do a very comprehensive review of this bill, and the Dash 1 amendments really are the pieces that should have been in the original bill. Because of some issues relative to drafting, it didn't work out that way. But we want to make the discussion about economic development a prospective discussion from this day forward. What we try to do is, in the old piece of legislation, is you try to go look back and say, what don't you do that's in the language of the statute, and how can you eliminate it or modify it to meet the expectations of our customers today and our legislative members of this assembly today. And so what you have in front of you is a bill that reflects where we are today and what we do, and not what we did 10 years ago nor what we did 20 years ago, but what we do today and how we have tried to reposition this agency to deal with the future of the economic opportunities that we will be faced with and the state will be faced with. And so it has housekeeping components in it. It has some very key components to our partners to allow some more fundable use of some of our resources. It gives clearer direction and better definition to the agency. Is there more discussion that will take place? I think you'll hear the senator and the representative talk about this. I think we will have more discussion in the future and work on it during the interim. But to the credit of the people who worked on this during the interim, I think it's an extremely important step for this agency to be able to start anew from this point and develop whatever other strategic changes need to be taken in the next coming interim and represent them. Change does not necessarily have to happen within a two-year window of time. It might take this session and the next session and possibly the next session to get everything that we need to do to get Oregon positioned to do the economic work that we need to do in the global market that we work in today. So I hope that you would review and consider these amendments in that vein. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Repine. We'll have Representative Edwards and Senator Johnson come forward now. We just started. Mr. Repine just gave us an overview of the amendment concept.
Right.
I guess might be the appropriate way to describe that.
Thank you, members of the committee, for the courtesy of being allowed to comment on the on this bill. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state representative from Senate District. State representative, sorry. I'm state senator from District 16. I have a fairly lengthy relationship with this bill by virtue of serving at the pleasure of the Senate President as an ex officio member to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission, as well as having chaired an interim committee on economic development wherein began the discussion about this bill. The interim committee started off as just a Senate committee, and it was very quickly clear that meeting with the House Committee on Economic Development under the gavel of Representative Lim made a good deal of sense. And so we met together throughout the summer. We were never formally amalgamated into a single committee, but the two committees met together, both to conserve the time and energy of the staff, as well as to have both the House and the Senate hear the same message from the agency simultaneously. During those interim meetings, work began on a restructuring of the agency. Actually, the work had begun during the time that Mike Salzgiver was the interim director there, and a new framework for doing business was laid out. Work then began on what was billed originally as a complete statutory rewrite for the agency that would try to bring a clarity of mission, clarity of deliverables. You could almost go through the statutes and see legislator by legislator where a program had been added to the statutes that guided the agency. And there had not been a comprehensive look-see at what the agency was doing. What were those things that were still enshrined in statute where we could declare victory and move on? Where were those things embedded in statute that the market conditions no longer made a viable exercise in economic development? And so that was kind of the framework that the discussion started. It was a very ambitious undertaking, and I think in hindsight, perhaps as Mr. Repine points out, perhaps too ambitious. And so this bill has been touted in the building as a statutory rewrite of the agency, and I think it comes to you now much more a housekeeping bill than it does an overhaul of the agency. Resting back on a comment I made about lots of things in this building, you don't need to hit a home run at every at-bat. And so I think this is a starting point to bring some housekeeping logic to some of the work of the agency. I would just add before I hand the microphone over to Representative Edwards that in a committee that he and I sit on together, I think there is growing interest in trying to have a more coherent way to do economic development, to try to get, for example, disciplined, priced, thoughtful lists that had been through some kind of degree of public scrutiny at the local level that would help guide investment so that we don't come into this building every other year and have 90 of us turn to the agency and say, what are you going to do for our district? We have not had a publicly user-friendly list of infrastructure investment with respect to water and sewer. Frequently, the way that it has happened, and this isn't a criticism of the agency. I think it's more of a kind of very high-level statement of what some of us have observed, that instead of having a disciplined list of sewer and stormwater and potable water projects, that instead we wait until communities come up with a failure, and then they come to the top. I think there's growing interest in the Economic and Transportation Subcommittee of Ways and Means to help direct the agency in a way that would bring these more disciplined project lists so there was some degree of predictability about how we were going to deliver economic development with good geographic equity and to figure out what are the projects that have come up from different regions that would lend to an overall economic vitality for the state. So, unfortunately, the text of SB 350 was not out of legislative council until last night. This is a complicated bill that I don't think has had a thorough vetting, particularly against the backdrop of public expectation about what it is going to do. I believe that the committee is just hearing testimony on it today and that it is not going to go into work session. If that's the case, I applaud that decision on the part of the chair. I think in fairness to the number of different stakeholders, having an opportunity to review the bill, given the lateness of its arrival, would be a very good thing. And with that, I would make myself available for questions, but defer to Representative Edwards.
Why don't we go ahead with Representative Edwards so that we can allow you, both of you, to move on, and then we'll see if we have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and other members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Edwards. I'm the state representative from House District 30. And I have a somewhat of a unique perspective on this bill. I'm a former legislative analyst for OECDD. I served there 2 years. My primary position was to review proposed state laws and to help determine which ones would grow the economy and create new jobs and save taxpayers money. I was also responsible for assessing the viability of key Oregon industries, that is, non-resource-based industries that the state hoped would offset losses from the natural resources sector. I'm currently working with the director, Bob Repine, on reviewing this bill and developing a path forward for the agency. My personal goal is to ensure that the agency is scoped properly and has the necessary infrastructure to do to be as effective as I think it can be under the leadership of Director Repine. My concern for the agency in the past has been that it's been treated as a political football by the legislature, and so its effectiveness has been severely diminished by the undue interference of the assembly. And my hope is to create, as Senator Johnson indicated, a much more coherent and effective agency. This bill is the first step in what I envision as a two-step process in order to develop sideboards around the agency to ensure that it has a clear mission, that it's certainly accountable to the Legislative Assembly, but at the same time has the leeway to do what it needs to do to be effective.
Thank you, Representative. Question three to the Senator Representative.
Yes, just one quick one. I know this is directed to Senator Johnson. I know a lot of the criticism that has been in the past is that there has been a number of projects that are, I would say, referred to as cosmetic projects, and then there are the substantive projects. With just approaching this from a housekeeping point of view, is that going to solve some of the issues that I know that you were very familiar with?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss-Anderson, let me start by saying I don't want any of my previous comments to be construed as a criticism of the agency. I think under Mr. Repine's leadership that some discipline is being brought to the agency and a degree of rigor. I sat in on a meeting the other day about a project that has a troubled past, and I was delighted to see the degree of rigor. But former retired bankers that are analysts for various projects that come forward, and they're looking at them now really as, would this project be bankable? What's the business plan? What are the economics? What are the metrics? How will we be able to audit success at the end? So I don't want anything that I've said to imply any criticism. I'm very optimistic about the leadership with Mr. Repine and Mr. Salzgiver. In answer to your question, I think a lot of attention is being paid to what are we buying for the investment. One of my old criticisms of the agency was that we were putting petunias in planters and we weren't creating jobs. And I think that under Mr. Repine's leadership, the agency has heard that message loud and clear. I think they also have heard in previous sessions and are certainly hearing from the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Economic Development and Transportation a message that we have to have a plan, we have to execute on the plan, and there have to be measurable deliverables at the end of the plan that translate into jobs or economic opportunity. And so it is my observation in answer to your question that we are doing many, many fewer cosmetic projects and much more projects of substance. I think the challenge for the agency is going to be how to be able to say no when 90 of us approach them, and I think we bear some culpability for this by using that agency as the place where we go to get money for our own districts. I think the challenge for the agency is going to be how do they manage their relationship with the legislature and have an economic development plan for the state that they can execute on. One of the examples, and just to show you the level of difficulty, is that this body created the Oregon Inc., the Oregon Innovation Council, and we tasked them with going out and showing the legislature where is going to be the next wave of economic opportunity. Extremely busy business people took time away from their professional lives to work at hours and hours and hours of meetings and review, and they delivered a very disciplined suite of projects. There were six elements to the project, totaling $38 million. The co-chair's budget funds that at 19. I think that that is illustrative of the challenge that the agency has. Lots and lots of good ideas, not enough money, and not a credible plan framework in which to evaluate those. The point that I'm trying to make here is that there will be an endless need for those of us that represent projects and places and people with good ideas. The challenge for the legislature is to figure out how do we help the agency provide credible and accountable delivery on those projects that comes in some coherent way. Personally, I think the suite of packages that were brought forward in the Oregon Inc. proposal are very solid. They've been skinnied down from their original $38 million price tag, and we're working at the committee level to try to figure out how to afford them. But I think having a list and a plan so that when you're sitting on an airplane as a state senator in the Oregon legislature and your seatmate says, what's Oregon's plan for economic development, that you would have something that was easily explicable and readily understandable. And we're moving in that direction with the adjustments in 350. But again, I want to use this forum and this time at the mic to lower expectations about what Senate Bill 350 is. It is not a complete overhaul of the agency. It is some badly needed tune-up for how the agency is going to deliver its product. But this is a work in progress, and I think we'll continue through the interim. I look forward very much to having Representative Edwards' expertise help guide the next steps.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Salzgiver, you have 6 minutes. And just for the committee's information and those in the audience, in 13 minutes we'll be going to our next item on the agenda.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salzgiver, Deputy Director for Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. You have before you the dash ones. There's also a set of dash two amendments, which we are not going to talk about today, except to say that the director, the reason we're not is because those amendments have not had the opportunity to be reviewed by our commission.
Okay.
And in the last 2 years, we have been made an extraordinary effort to bring all of our work through that commission so that they can review it, vet it, make comments on it, and make recommendations both to the governor and to the legislature. So we will set those aside for a different day to talk about, but it is a concept that our agency strongly supports and will be happy to work with the Department of State Lands on. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if I could, you have in front of you a section-by-section analysis of the Dash 1 Amendment. It is, as you've noted, sir, a very long bill, and so what I'll do is call attention to some highlights and try to compress an analysis of it and then be available for any questions. Sections 1 through 10 of the bill address the statutes which govern the department's administrative provisions. So these administrative sections of the agency statutes were recognized as high priority areas of focus upon receiving the initial bill. It resulted in a set of statements that consolidate the purpose and strategy of the department and provide clarity toward our administrative responsibilities. They set forth much clearer findings that are consistent both with the direction of the Oregon Business Plan and the state's Economic Development Strategic Plan, which was adopted by our commission last year. It also streamlines and consolidates certain statutory authority. These sections also provide authority to the director. When Senator Johnson talked about the process we began a year and a half ago, there were four basic principles that guided us as we began this review, and one was to be highly responsive, very efficient with the public's resources, very agile and very flexible. And so one of those provisions of flexibility, with the checks and balances that we understand the legislature and the governor are looking for, is to provide authority to the director and the department as it conducts its daily activities in accordance with strong, prudent fiscal practices, in accordance with strong planning that recognize the responsibilities of the department. That's really focused in Section 7 and 8. Throughout the rest of the bill, we mentioned in previous hearings that we also focused on community development and business development. Although this particular amendment repeals Section 285A, 125 through 141 of the ORS. We are working with our partners to talk, which is dealing with our trade commission. We're continuing to work with the governor's office and our key stakeholders on addressing that issue. There, in an earlier draft of the bill, the Oregon Progress Board and the Tourism Commission, Travel Oregon, were treated in a way that was not intentional. Those provisions have been deleted, and those two bodies are not being repealed, sunsetted, or deleted, but rather being moved to more appropriate sections of the Oregon Revised Statutes. And so there's a key administrative change. The bulk of the community development provisions set forth provisions that tie our work more to strong business planning, as does the business finance sections. And we have changed the names of some funds from older names to the current use of fund names that we currently use. I would point out in Section 11, which is roughly pages 21 through 24, Brownfield Redevelopment Fund, that is a fund that has drawn an enormous amount of attention, particularly as we have done our certified industrial land work. And we have recommended an increase of the amount that we could award for the cleanup of these lands, which is consistent with federal direction and direction we've also received from our commission. So we've changed a number of other funds. We've prepared the agency for other legislation that is currently working its way through the legislative process. And the rest of the provisions in sections roughly 15 through 17 are basic house cleaning and other provisions. As you move into sections 18 and beyond, pages 30 and ahead, that starts to deal with our business finance programs. In these areas, we have particularly Section 18. I know there's a lot of interest in small business programs. We are proposing changes that increase our oversight capacity of in terms of small business development centers. And we changed the manner or improved the manner, really, in which we're working with those individual centers to provide support to Oregon small businesses. Sections 19 through 22, again.
Just a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monasanders.
Just on page 31, the grant, you're talking about their final report.
That's correct.
And I know you state that they will just have to report if they delivered the services. In the application process, will you have outcomes, or and that's what you mean by services delivered?
Chair Metzger, Senator Monson-Sanderson, that's correct. Actually, we build those requirements into the contracts through which we distribute the funds. If going forward, again, you'll notice one area that I want to bring to your attention. There's been a lot of discussion about treatment of requiring individual divisions named in statute. One of the other administrative responsiveness and yet flexibility or agility provisions we're asking for is to sunset the naming of specific divisions, particularly the ports division. The requirement that we have trade offices in particular countries, again, through the commission process, through an engaged and active interaction with our key customers and stakeholders, we have asked for the director to have, consistent with clear findings and legislative direction, the authority to put create administrative elements of the agency and place offices and locations where they fit our strategic plan. Sections 30 through and 31 really talk about are some additional house cleaning. We have on section 32 through 37, there are some additional changes with respect to how community development projects are defined and how the statute treats the Special Public Works Fund. I point out for the committee that the Special Public Works Fund represents roughly 87% of the resources that flow through our agency. And that is the fund that takes care of our infrastructure work with our local governments. And so we're recommending a number of changes here that address the treatment of that fund. Mr. Chairman, I think you can see with this, I'm mindful of the time, this is the flow of the work that has unfolded as we have addressed individual funds, individual programs, once again, to provide clarity, to streamline language, to provide clearer direction, to tie them to strategic and business planning, and also to provide tie them more closely to decision-making criteria. And that is what flows through the remainder of the bill. So I think rather than just go through a tedious section by section here, we have that written here. It's available to the public, and I'll be happy to stop at this point. And then the rest of the bill is really house cleaning in terms of cleaning up inconsistent or no longer required statutory language. So with that, I'd be happy to stop and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Salzgaber. And I appreciate everyone's recognition of the fact that we just got a, 88-section amendment. So, and we all understand that.
111 pages.
We will, and we're going to take some time to look at this. But I would say, if there's questions right now for Mr. Salzgaber, please. Senator George.
Real quick, if I could. I just wanted to compliment the agency. The other day I got to sit in a meeting with some of the regional folks and in one of the cities in my jurisdiction, in my district. And I just want to appreciate the activities of the department. So thank you very much.
That's good. Senator George, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. So what we're going to do, members, is since we have this large bill and in fact the department hasn't had much time to look at the amendment either to see whether that's exactly what they propose. We don't want to amend 100 pages into a bill and find out that we want to change it again because that's not ecologically sound management. So my intent is to bring this bill back a week from today, which is our next to last meeting, for final work session. And what I would ask members to do, go through this, match it up. I'm sure Mr. Repine, Mr. Salzgaber, and others will be available to members to answer your personal questions about issues. And if there are additional amendments because of clarification, we'll want to get those in. Keep us apprised, all the members of the committee, if there are some additional changes so that we're kind of all on the same page when this happens. And then we'll look, hopefully, on Wednesday for a work session. This bill does go down to Ways and Means and afford it an opportunity to move through at that time. Okay? So with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 350. And let's see where we are with our members. I don't see any of them have arrived. It's just a couple minutes early for 2:30. So I think what we'll do is, if I find my bill, we're going to open up public hearing on House Bill 2372, and I'm going to turn it over to Janet to give us an explanation of 2372.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2372 would require that employers of 25 or more employees provide unpaid rest periods to employees to express milk if providing rest periods does not cause undue hardship to the business or on the operation of the or other employees in the business. It requires employers to make reasonable efforts to provide private locations where employees can express milk. There are some limits in the bill. The employer is allowed to use single or multiple undue hardship factors to justify the exemption. It requires employees to give reasonable notice to employers of their intent to express milk in the workplace. And an amendment that was added in the House was to exclude the topic of breast expressing from collective bargaining for school districts. There are civil penalties provided for intentional violations and an advisory council created. Mr. Chair, you do have the A-19 and the A-20 amendments. Representative Gilliam is the sponsor of the Anyway, the Dash 20 amendments are conflict amendments with Senate Bill 400, so they need to be adopted because Senate Bill 400 is leading, and I'm not sure who's speaking to the 19s.
Okay. Maybe this is the antithesis of the bottle bill, correct? So. Representative Berger. So, we have Representative Berger, Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Maurer, Representative Olson. We got a fearsome foursome here.
Hopefully.
All right. Thank deferring to the ladies. But they're adding up. Okay. Welcome.
Go ahead. I have no prepared. Members of the committee, Vicki Berger, State Representative. District 20. I have no prepared remarks except to say that we're not going to get a nickel on this. As one of the co-sponsors of this bill and someone who has been as supportive of this idea from last session, and I hope we're referring to House Bill 2372, I would just urge you to understand that a lot of hard work went into this bill. It didn't, the bill we started with and the bill, you heard how many amendments we've worked on, and it's because the folks who worked this bill in the House are dedicated to this concept and wanted to come to terms with how to make it work. I think we're there. I think that there may be some other tweaks, but this is something that we can do for Oregonians, for a segment of our working population that is probably most vulnerable, and who in today's world has one of the greatest needs to be in the workplace of any generations before them in terms of the economic need. Nursing mothers traditionally stay home and take care of their babies for untold generations, but they don't do that now. The economic reality is a lot of them are working. This is a small thing, but it's a very big thing if you are one of that small, very special population who is trying to juggle the needs of a baby, the needs of the economic needs of your family, and your own emotional needs. So I would urge you to look favorably with consideration on this very well-worked bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Diane Rosenbaum, House District 42. And Speaker Pro Tem of the Oregon House, and I'm also very pleased today to appear here in support of House Bill 2372 and to be a chief co-sponsor along with Representative Berger, who just spoke. I think that this bill is truly a family-friendly bill that will do a lot for the health of Oregon children and their mothers, and it will be good for business ultimately, because we know that breastfeeding causes babies to be healthier, moms to be healthier, and not just at the time but later in life too. And so the payoff in the long run for everyone is that we'll have less absenteeism, we'll have people at work who want to be at work and know that at the same time they're not making these painful choices between their family and their job, which is a dilemma for lots of people today. I think that I do have written testimony, which I'll give you in a moment, but essentially this evidence is just overwhelmingly clear that breastfeeding, especially in the first 12 months after birth, is crucial to the development of healthy kids, and that's ought to be paramount to everything, I think, that we're trying to do here. I also, and I'm sure you will see this dramatically very soon with the testimony to follow, want to let you know that this bill passed unanimously out of its Committee of Origin over on the House side. So all the Republicans and all the Democrats were supporting this bill. It passed the House overwhelmingly, and I think that it makes it clear that this is something that is not controversial, that there is an exemption in the bill for businesses for whom it's too great a hardship to comply. And so I think that we've crafted a bill that, if not perfect, is about as close as I've seen us come. And I think it is really one of the better things we're going to be able to do for families this session. So I'm very glad you're hearing it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. I remember having this bill, not exactly this bill, but the same concept back in 01 in my business committee, so it has been around a while. I will ask you, before I go on to Senator Burdick, are you familiar with the Dash 19? I'm trying to figure out who the author is of the A-19 amendment. and whether that has the sponsors are familiar with it or not.
I am
well, not right now. If you're the one, just wave, and you can talk about
it. Okay.
It's not me, but I can add information to it.
Well, come forward then.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I am in another committee.
So yes, thank you, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Industries. When this bill was heard in the House, Representative Gilliam asked that any fines or penalties be passed on to the Human Services Breastfeeding Friendly Employer Project. That was a promise of an amendment that would be made, presented here before the Senate.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a real pleasure to be here. I have been involved in this issue for, feels like my whole legislative career sometimes. This bill is, first of all, I just wanted to thank you for your timely hearing of this bill. I think this will be a good thing to count up as an accomplishment this session, and I really appreciate your leadership on this. This bill is a pro-woman bill, it's a pro-baby bill, and it's a pro-business bill. The nice thing about this bill is it will allow businesses to do really what is in the best interest of their employees and their employees' children. Breastfed babies are so much healthier than other babies. They cause less absenteeism on the part of their mothers from sick leave. I'm a former breastfeeding mother myself, and I never had a sick baby visit to the doctor in the 2 years I nursed my baby. And so hopefully my employers got the benefit of it. At least I hope they have liked having me there all the time. So this is a pro-business bill. It's also a bipartisan bill, and I want to commend my colleagues in the House for all the work they did on this bill to really make it into something that could get bipartisan support, could get business support, and really will accomplish a lot in terms of accommodating the very, very important public policy of encouraging mothers to nurse as long as possible. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Are you in committee now?
I am. I'm okay. Chairing a committee.
Well, I'll let you go because I know what that's like. Thank you very much for your advocacy. Representative.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Chair Metzger and members of the committee, I'm Representative Ron Maurer from House District 3, Grants Pass. And I just want to let you know that as a Republican on the Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee, that we worked very long and hard on this bill to make it the best bill that we could. And I'll have to say that the Dash 18 amendment finally passed. And I don't want to say that all of that was because we worked so hard on the bill, but because there are five freshmen on that committee, and that there were a number of issues of us just learning how to work the system.
Well, we were hoping you wouldn't learn.
For sure. But when I first heard the bill, I was skeptical about this impact on business. And with the help of Diane Garrett, who's in the audience today, and her diligence in this effort, she made a statement early on that really struck me, and that was that the legislation that we're creating here for this bill is going to be looked at across the country as model legislation that could be implemented in other states. And therefore, I looked at this job as it's not just about Oregon, but what's good for business, what's good for babies, what's good for mothers, and what's good for other states to follow through. And so we did a lot of work on the impact on business, and we tried to minimize that impact knowing that employers could be very resistant to this type of program, but also knowing that that the benefit for the mother and the baby are undeniable. And so we were able to get a consensus, and there was no resistance or any resistance of any magnitude from the business community as a result of this work. So I'd encourage you to, and as I read the amendments, to adopt those amendments. They seem appropriate, and move forward with this bill, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is and members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm state representative from the Albany area. And I was not forced to be here. Okay. But I'm 100% behind this bill, and I'm one of the vice chairs on the Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee on the House side. And I'll just flat tell you, and this is what I shared from the floor, too, when this bill was heard on the floor last month. I was opposed to this bill initially, and through the just the leadership of the chair that we have over there, Carolyn Tomei, and also the members and the structure of our committee, we were able to find some really good common ground. And now that we've passed it, and now that I've also been a grandfather the second time now, I know it's hard for you to believe, my oldest daughter returned back to work after her 12 weeks of medical leave. And she's in an environment where there's more than 25 employees. She's still wanting to, you know, save her milk and everything for her little boy. And it's interesting to hear the dilemma that she's facing now, because there's nothing being provided for. So what does she do? She goes out to her vehicle. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. And so what it did was it just supported that I made the right decision in supporting this bill and where we have it today. And I appreciate you considering it and would urge you to pass it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I do want to get to our advocates. Let's see, I have Representative Tomei here, and then I think we can get to our advocates. I think they're getting worried that the legislature is going to run out the clock on them before they get to testify.
Thank you so much. I don't have prepared testimony. For the record, I'm Carolyn Tomei, state representative from House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. I just was so proud of my committee. As you can see, with 18 amendments, we worked really hard to get this through. And I did have five freshmen on that committee, and they worked so hard. I'm really proud of them. I'm proud of the advocates. We heard lots and lots of testimony from the medical community, from advocates for children, from pediatricians, how important this bill is, and I'm very proud of this product. I'm proud of my committee for, and obviously Diane Garrett and the group that she's with, too. So I'd urge you to support the bill.
Thank
you for hearing it so quickly. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. And just because the representation was made that the committee had been advised of the desire for the A19, of which any penalties going to the Breastfeeding Mother Friendly Employer Project would be placed into the bill. And since you're the chairwoman, is that correct representation? Is this an amendment you would like?
This is the first time I've seen that amendment, so I don't have an opinion on that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Ms. Garrett, you and your two companions would like to come forward. Libby Schwartz and Lori Meter. Welcome. And thanks
Thank you.
You've learned a lot about energy today and economic development, and
yeah.
It's amazing.
Power of the people and all of that. For the record, my name is Diane Garrett, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. I'm deeply grateful that you are taking the time to address the needs of moms and babies today. It's truly, I'm sincerely grateful for the time. I know you're very busy. I'm simply coming to ask for your help so that we can create a community where it is possible for moms to breastfeed their children. And in Oregon, women of childbearing age are 28% of our workforce. So if we are going to give the education to moms that says breastfeeding is essential, we also have to account for the environment in which that is or is not happening. And when moms return to work, obviously they're separated from their babies. And we have to come up with a strategy for workplace conditions so that moms can keep nursing their babies and thereby enjoying the health benefits of breast milk. From where I sit, the point I would like to make is that it's simply an act of human decency that we consider these basic needs with regard to the care and nurturance of our children. It's really not any more complicated than that. The bill would place a requirement on businesses 25 and greater. Statistically, that's 10%. It's about 11,000 businesses statewide. So 90% of Oregon businesses do not have to pay attention to this bill, only 10%. The basic accommodations are unpaid time and a private place. So we're not asking that the mom be compensated for the time she takes. If she gets a 10-minute rest period by law, she can use that time. Otherwise, she is off the clock. The private place, we are requesting reasonable efforts for it to be other than a bathroom stall. Lots of moms have express milk in bathroom stalls, and it's time for that to stop. I think we can all agree that this should have more dignity afforded to it than that. Some workplaces will be able to have a higher degree of privacy than others, so we have not placed a detailed description around that. We are not requiring a locking door on a construction site. We're just asking that it not be, you know, the Schultzy. I also, lastly, would like to indicate that the Bureau of Labor and Industries is providing multiple avenues for exemption and assistance. So there's undue hardship provisions. There is an advisory committee that would be convened if a specific industry is having difficulty. And if all of those attempts at mediation and problem solving fail, then we would move on to the penalty phase. Then the penalty is the same as current rest period violations, which is $1,000 per day. To tell you the truth, I'm not anticipating a steady revenue stream on this. What I anticipate is that this will educate the community, and we will see widespread change because it will reach 70% of the total workforce. So for that 10%, we're going to reach two-thirds of the people in Oregon and send a message that breastfeeding is essential, and we can do this. And that is all that I would like to say. There is some additional paper that I have included with my testimony, and I again thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Garrett, and again, thanks for abbreviating the testimony. We sure appreciate your advocacy so we can move through and hear from our other two people.
Chair Metzger, yes. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lauren Keir. I'm here in support of House Bill 2372. I am the Women's Health Division Director at OHSU and responsible for 11,500 employees receiving the benefit of OHSU being designated a breastfeeding mother-friendly employer. In 2000, the U.S. Surgeon General actually stated that breastfeeding was one of the most important contributing factors for infant health. And I'd like to briefly provide some concrete scientific data as well as some fiscal data to support that assertion. Breast milk, the immunologic properties reduce morbidity and mortality to several bacterial and viral infections, including respiratory infections, pneumonia, necrotizing enterocolitis, which is a brutal infection that actually is quite lethal to our premature infants, bacterial meningitis, bacteremia, otitis media. It's also been documented in the literature that human breast milk is protective against juvenile onset diabetes, sudden infant death syndrome, asthma, allergies, several childhood cancers, as well as adult hypertension. The benefits also are well documented to extend to the health of the mother and includes a reduction in risk of ovarian cancer, type 2 diabetes, premenopausal breast cancer, postmenopausal hip fracture, as well as improvement in mood response. As of 2002, the U.S. Department of Health stated that if we would increase the breastfeeding rate by simply 20%, we would reduce health care costs by $3.6 billion. Now, what's important to note is that less than 30% of women are still breastfeeding, and a primary barrier reported by women in the literature is returning to work. Furthermore, the breastfeeding rates are increased and maintained in businesses where an employer-sponsored program to support lactation is in place. And if you briefly consider the demographics of the workforce, women are the fastest-growing segment. 70% of women with children under the age of 3 work full-time. 33% of women return to work within 3 months of giving birth, and 67% return within 6 months. This initiative at OHSU is what we administrators describe as a low-yield, high-impact initiative. It's relatively little effort for maximum return. And briefly, the reduced absenteeism, which has been mentioned, is documented, as well as lower health care costs that are identified immediately, on average of $400 per infant per year. There is also a documented $3 return on investment for every dollar invested in a breastfeeding support program. as well as improved employee productivity and engagement. Now, what we've observed at OHSU, I'm sure many of you are aware that it's not possible to create more space on Markham Hill that's already being utilized. And what we have found is that this initiative, with 11,600 employees, there are only actually about, at this time, 10 designated rooms. But what we do have is conversations occurring and planning occurring between employees and their supervisors. We have a locker room with one corner cornered off for women to be able to pump privately. The Primate Center has identified a closet. My point being is that this policy was adopted mid-fiscal year with no budgeted monies to support it, but the creativity that's being employed by both employees and their supervisors is really supportive, and we expect to quantify that with some of our retention data that we're exploring as well. As you can conclude, this is beneficial. This is win-win for employers, employees, and family members. And one final note, Quint Studer, one of the greatest corporate minds of our time, actually talks about a concept where businesses use a term that he calls terminal uniqueness, meaning employees' reasons why they can't be creative and supply something for their employees rather than moving ahead and doing the right thing for employees. So this is in healthcare. If healthcare, many of the major organizations in the state have employed the breastfeeding legislation, it's not a matter of convenience to cover an ICU nurse so that she can go pump. It could potentially be a matter of life and death for a patient that's receiving the care. So I would like to answer any questions and request that the committee really understand the clinical implications to the population in the state by supporting this bill.
Thank you very much. We have a couple more minutes. Ms. Schwartz, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Libby Schwartz. I'm a partner at the law firm of Perkins Coie's office in Portland, and I'm just here to provide a little bit of anecdotal evidence, both from the business perspective and from my own perspective, because I nursed both of my children while I was working. They are now 5 and 3, and had a very supportive workplace environment. There was no money available to designate a specific location when I came back from maternity leave after my first child, but I was placed into a closet. That was fine. It didn't have any dangerous chemicals in it. It had an outlet and a chair. That was all that I needed. I have been able to keep productive throughout both periods of nursing with both of my children. There was a telephone. We had an upgrade in the second facility that we used. So I could make telephone calls. I could go through documents, and it really didn't have any sort of decrease in my workplace productivity. Anecdotally, in terms of the health of my children, as I said, they are now 5 and 3. Just as an example, I think between the two of them, they've had a total of 3 ear infections in their combined lives. So I think a lot of that was due to the fact that they were getting breast milk. It's made them a lot healthier. From the business standpoint, we do now have a facility where we have a designated space, which also has a refrigerator, not required by the bill, but something that my firm has done. And 4 women have used the space to express milk at work since 2003, and one of them is currently using it now. And it has increased their loyalty towards the firm, their productivity has not decreased, and again, they have not had to be out of the office very much with sick children. So it really has been an overall net positive for all participants involved, and I urge your support of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank all 3 of you and for your advocacy. Is there any burning question from the committee here? Okay, thank you very much. We have 5 minutes. You see people are already starting to come in for the other committee. I have Dan Gardner, Dr. Jim Lacey, and Catherine Bradley signed up. You both all have indicated you have written testimony. So I don't have time, since you are in support of the bill, that is if we want to pass the bill, to actually orally testify, but what I do have 2 minutes. I'd like the 3 of you to come up, if you could, and just say you're a supporter of the bill. We'll take your written testimony, but at least people will see officially you're on the record. And then we might actually have time to pass it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I am extremely supportive of the bill.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Dr. Lacy, thank you for coming.
Senator and members of the committee, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and we are in favor of this bill.
And I hope to see you again very soon on another bill regarding ATVs.
Okay.
Welcome.
Chair Metzger and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, which does house the maternal child health programs and the WIC program, and we are in support of this bill. And in the materials that are being handed out to you are actually WIC updates for your counties specifically that will give you information about the range of breastfeeding initiation within your counties. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, all of you, and for your support, and thank you to the advocates for your hard work. As I indicated, it was 6 years ago that my business committee, actually I was a member at that time, you know, first dealt with this issue, and it's kind of moved through different stages. And all the people who have worked, especially in the business community, to work to make this, you know, where you have it today. And really, really appreciate that. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2372, open a work session, and we have a dash A-19 and a dash A-20 conflict amendment before us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the dash A-19 amendment to House Bill 2372.
Senator Starr has moved the dash A-19 amendment to House Bill 2372. Discussion? Objection? It's ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I didn't support Senate Bill 400. And I'm not sure that I care that whether or not it's in this bill. So I'm not going to be supportive of that amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes.
I move the dash 20 amendments to the House Bill 2372.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved the dash A20 amendment to House Bill 2372.
What is
further discussion on that amendment?
I'm going to oppose the amendment, but ultimately not oppose the bill.
Okay. Any other opposition to the amendment? Senator George and Senator Starr, please note as oppositions to the A20 amendment. No other opposition. So ordered. Senator Starr.
I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2372 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes.
I want the public to know that we do have breastfeeding rooms here in the Capitol, and I do know that one of them is outside of the Senate gallery on the third floor. I'm not sure where the one is on the House side. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Senator George.
It's general policy that I oppose mandates, and so I spent quite a bit of time with one of the advocates in my office today arguing back and forth, and she convinced me that the safeguards they put in for business was enough that I think this is something that I can support. So I'll be voting for the bill, even though it probably goes against something that I typically am pretty strong on my principles on. But on this one, I think that the safeguards have been put in not to be too much of a burden on business. So I appreciate the advocates coming in and explaining their position to me.
Thank you, Senator. Any other comments?
I'll save mine for the floor, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, so ordered, and we'll ask that the chief sponsor, Senator Burdick, be the carrier of the bill, and we will be back at 5 o'clock, and we're recessed until 5 o'clock.